Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. In this Dharma Talk, Lama Kathy Wesley completes her series based on the book The Day of a Buddhist Practitioner by Bokar Rinpoche, this time examining the end of the day. Being tired at the end of the day, it's easy to gear back, switch off, and go numb as a reaction to the stresses of the day. By understanding a dharmic approach to stress and an approach to the infinite aspects of mind, we can dissolve the day's worries and come to rest in mind's basic nature at the close of the day. Enjoy the podcast.
Thank you so much for coming today. It's good to see you, and thank you for being here. This is my first visit back to see all of you since I went to New York to help out with the Columbus KTC fundraising table at the event sponsored by the Da Nang Foundation for His Holiness Karmapa's teaching on the 37 practices of a bodhisattva in Riverside Church in New York City. The Riverside Church is one of the most beautiful of the churches in the city of New York. It was built by the Rockefeller family, and it is gigantic and amazing. And inside the sanctuary of this gigantic and amazing church resounded the words of Dharma for 3 days. So underneath all of the religious imagery of the Christian faith, they opened their doors and allowed the Buddhists to come in and to set up camp for 3 days, and it was really glorious. His Holiness Karmapa is now in his early 30s, and he has been in the United States for about a year, convalescing from an illness, and now he's becoming more public in his teachings and his activities. And it's been really amazing to see him develop as a teacher. The 37 actions of a bodhisattva are not easy to hear because it says such things as if you fight outer opponents while not taming the enemy of your own anger, outer opponents will only multiply. Therefore, with an army of loving kindness and compassion, to practice patience is the practice of a bodhisattva. So it can be a challenging book, we'll put it that way. And to hear this wonderful person, His Holiness Karmapa, to hear him explain the meaning of these things and what patience is and how to practice it, it was really just beyond. It was just amazing. For example, he said, we sometimes think of other people or other situations as being our enemy. Our enemy. We have an enemy, somebody who's trying to stop us from doing what we want to do. And we think of that person as an enemy or that situation. And he said, but really, they're just at the mercy of their mental afflictions. They are not in control of their mental afflictions. And he said, so we have to look at that person with a sense of, I guess you could say, a compassion and empathy. These days we say, I feel you, meaning I feel what you are feeling, and I feel the pain that you are feeling, and I hope that you and I can both be released from this pain. And so it's very interesting. He said what we should do instead is recognize that we, even the person we are in conflict with, have a common enemy. And the common enemy is our own mental afflictions. And if we can somehow team up to fight our own mental afflictions with love and compassion, or at least with restraint, then we can actually become friends in the fight against mental afflictions rather than enemies in a fight against each other. I loved the teachings that I heard, and I hope you get a chance to watch them, because through the miracle of YouTube, they are currently available. And you can watch them. It is a 5-part series on YouTube, on the Karmapa's YouTube channel. And it will be marked 1 of 5, 2 of 5, 3 of 5, and so forth. And then you can watch them all. Please pardon me. I was sitting near the front, and Lama Karma Wangdu, who was just with us in our Mahakala Puja, he said, "I saw you." And I said, "Gosh, I sure hope I wasn't like scratching too much or anything like that." He said, "You're on TV." It was very weird. During that 3 days, being in close proximity with His Holiness and watching all of the people interact with him was really inspiring, because here is a young man who has dedicated his life to studying and practicing Dharma. That's all he does. He studies Dharma, he practices Dharma, and he tries to communicate Dharma to other people. He wrote a wonderful book called The Heart is Noble, in which he described modern relationships and modern society and modern economy and the ecology of the world, of the planet. He wrote a second book called Interconnected, in which he also described the interrelationship of people and how we're all part of one family trying to make this earth a habitable place. And so if you have a chance to learn more about his books, The Heart is Noble or Interconnected, I recommend them to you. I think we're going to start studying Interconnected either late this year or early next year, so stay tuned. We'll be able to do that. It was also a time to see people I had not seen for a very long time from all over the world, because literally people from all over the world came to New York City to Riverside Church to see him for 3 days. And we got to meet a lot of people too, because Kenpo Tenkyong, the president of KTD, permitted us to have a fundraising table there. And we were able to get His Holiness to bless copies of the 37 practices and also statues of the Buddha of Purity, Vajrasattva. And we offered those to people for donations. And I don't have a total yet, but when we have a total, we'll let you know. But I think it was good. I think it was good. I think it was more than $10,000. So we met also a lot of people there. And the people we met were inspired by our story. They had never heard it. You remember, many of these people came from different parts of the world, including Hong Kong. And we had our story there in Chinese and in English, and they began to understand what it meant to us to lose our building and what it means to us to try to reestablish a new home. So in any case, it was delightful and wonderful to meet them all and to make connection with them. And they all said they'd be praying for us. This one lady, she had lived a lot of her adult life in India, and she didn't have money. She says, "I'd love to give you some money, but I have nothing." I said, "Don't worry, just pray for us. Just pray for us. You don't have to have a lot of money. Just say prayers for us. And the prayers that you say will help other people to help us." So I said, there's nothing wasted. Even if you don't have a dime, just do some prayers and dedicate those prayers to us, and it will help us. So that was the Riverside Church event. It was amazing. I went then to Cape Cod to do some teaching on the weekend in Boston and on Cape Cod. And then the following week, I went back, hopefully also to do fundraising for KTC at the 5-day North American Kaju Prayer Festival called the Munlam, which was held at York College in Queens. However, we were not scheduled to have a table like we did at the other place. So all I did was carry around a book that I created with pictures of the old center, pictures of the new, and an encouragement to donate. So I just walked around, and anybody who wanted to know about how things were going, I showed them the book. We would call that low-key. I met a couple of people who said, well, I have family members who are interested in Dharma. Maybe they will help you out. So that was that. But during the Munlam, His Holiness gave teachings on wisdom, and it was just amazing to hear him teach first the previous week on compassion and then on this week on wisdom and how to see things clearly, how to let go of our way of looking of things and see things clearly without confusion. So I got to only hear a few days of that because one of the Western lamas at the event became ill. And this was at 7 o'clock in the morning during the first prayer session. And the president of KTD came up to me and said, can you go to the hospital with this lama? And I said, yes. And so for 4 days then I was at Lenox Hill Hospital in Manhattan because he was transferred there, having become very ill. And so we put him on the plane to go back to his home state on Thursday. And I came home on Friday. So right now it's Sunday, right? It's Sunday, right? And I'm in Ohio, yes? And I am finishing my talk on the day of a Buddhist practitioner, right? I'm in the right place doing the right thing, right? Okay. I need your reassurance. Thank you. So thank you for indulging me and letting me spend about 10 minutes telling you the story about seeing Karmapa in New York. It was like a dream. I mean, really, it's like a dream to see this great young man who is so articulate and so able to express Dharma so simply and so clearly. We're very lucky to have teachers like him coming up because some of us are getting older. A few of us are getting older and we need the next generation to come and help us. When I got to see our founder, Kempo Karcha Rinpoche, I was a little embarrassed because I didn't have the traditional white Tibetan silk scarf to offer him as a greeting. You know, it's the white Tibetan silk scarf, it's kind of old-fashioned. It's kind of like the Hawaiian lei, the flower garland that people give you to say hello and goodbye in Hawaii, only it's made out of cloth. And so I went to greet the man who's been my teacher for like 40 years. And I said, oh, I'm so embarrassed. I don't have the traditional white scarf to offer you. And then he touched my gray hair in the front. And he said, oh, don't worry. He said, this is your white scarf. So that touched me because he's 94 years old and will be becoming 95. And I am 64 years old and will be coming 65. So it's really fun to have he watched me grow up, if you know what I mean. And he's been so kind to me and continues to teach us and guide us. And so we're very fortunate to have a person like Rinpoche as our teacher. Just so you know, this will be the last announcement before we get on the freeway and start studying this book. But Rinpoche, in honor of his 95th observation of his 95th birthday, there's going to be a special prayer service for him this week. They brought in I like to call them the pros from Dover, but you have to have read a book called MASH to understand who the pros from Dover are. But they brought in these professional, wonderful women chanters from Bhutan. And the sort of the sub-theme of this year's Kaju Munlam Prayer Festival was the power of women. And so instead of having the traditional male group leading the chanting, all the chants were led by women. And they were present and front and center for the Marme Munlam, which is the lamp aspiration at Madison Square Garden. They offered three beautiful performances and were just really stunning. Their voices are stunning. Well, they're going to be at KTD Monastery this week, starting on the 21st, which is Thursday. So Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, they'll be offering long life prayers for Rinpoche. And it's possible Karmapa will attend. So I won't be able to be there because I have a family member who's undergoing some testing at that time, so I won't be able to go, but You can, I don't know if they'll broadcast it or not, but if they do, you can keep your eyes out for it. So thank you again for letting me catch you up on the news. So now we're going to talk about the Day of a Buddhist Practitioner. This is the last of the three parts of this series. The first one was about the Day of a Buddhist Practitioner, morning. The second part was Day of a Buddhist Practitioner, midday. And then the third part is the Day of a Buddhist Practitioner, evening. When I meet people who aren't Buddhist, they ask, well, what do Buddhists do exactly? Do you do anything? And I say, well, you know, we don't have a specific day of the week that is our Sabbath day when we observe meditation and prayer. We actually do it every day. We wake up in the morning and we go to our image of the Buddha and we make an aspiration for the day and we bow to the Buddha, who is our teacher, the Dharma, which is our path, and the Sangha, our community. We symbolically bow to them in the form of the shrine, and we recite prayers of taking refuge, saying, this day, I will devote myself to the Buddha as my teacher, the Dharma as my path, and the Sangha as my community, and I will recognize that I have Buddha nature too, and I will try to uncover my Buddha nature today through wisdom and through compassion. So I said, so for a Buddhist, every day is Sunday. Every day is the day we observe our faith. Every day is the day we think about our potential and try to bring that potential to fruition. So every day is that day. And of course, that confuses some people because it seems like a little bit of a burden. I mean, really, think about it. By contrast, some people really have it easy. They can go to church one day a week and everything's fine. Everything is right, and they don't have to think about it for the rest of the week until the next time. But being a Buddhist is, shall we say, a bit of a drag. It's not easy. In fact, but Karmapa had something to say about this during one of the teachings. He said, sometimes we carry our Dharma responsibility like a burden, like a heavy load that we're carrying. But he said, really, if you think about it, being able to think of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha and meditate is becoming more aware, and it actually is making you lighter. You're lighter. What you do is lighter. It's not a burden. You can carry it lightly. And so the practices that we do throughout the day, the morning Dharma, the midday Dharma, and the evening Dharma are all about lightening the load so we don't have to feel like we're alone. And so that's really the function of the structure of Buddhist morning practice, Buddhist midday practice, and Buddhist evening practice. So when we talked about Buddhist morning practice, we talked about setting our motivation for the day. That's what His Holiness the Dalai Lama told that wonderful reporter from CNN when he was interviewed so many years ago. They said, what's the first thing you think of in the day? He said, my motivation. I'm trying to be kind and loving and compassionate for the benefit of all beings. And then he says, I try to carry that through the day and into the night. And so that's the morning practice, is to make that motivation and carry it. The midday practice is to try to hold that motivation in the midst of everything. Because we know what the middle of the day is like. You go someplace and you have a problem. You meet somebody and they give you a problem. Or something happens, or this happens, or that happens, and you feel, I have a problem. And so we meet lots of problems. And so what is the Buddhist response? What is the Buddhist practice with these problems? The Karmapa, when he was teaching, he said the main thing to do is not grasp or clamp down on what is happening, but rather to step back one step and see what the entire situation is. Don't just clamp down on this person or this thing you think of as being your problem. He said, back up and take a look at that person and what they're going through. See what their fears are. See what their suffering is. And see that they too are only just trying to get through their day. They may choose a different way than you choose, and that may put you into conflict. Or they may have had something terrible happen in their life that day, and they may be suffering. And their suffering may, for them, come out as anger or as what one of my relatives used to call cussedness. They're just cussedness. They're just against things. So it may come out like that. But if we don't clamp down, but rather back up and bring light and air into the situation, we can step back and see that person is suffering. And then instead of saying, "Why are you so bad?" we can say, "How are you hurting? How are you hurting? What can I do for you? How can I help you?" Of course, that may just make it worse. But because some people, when you say they're in such a bad mood that when you say good morning, they will take it as a threat. But you can back up, and if you stop coming at them with some kind of negativity, if you lighten up your negativity, because sometimes, you know what they say, sometimes people fight fire with fire. Somebody gets mad, then we get mad back, and it just escalates. But what if, instead of getting angry, we back up a step and see what's going on with that other person before we speak, before we do anything? We've got time. We have Buddha nature. Nothing that person says is going to hurt our Buddha nature. Maybe it'll hurt our ego fixation a little bit, but our Buddha nature is permanent and beautiful and wonderful and cannot be harmed by anything. It continues with us from life to life and is the seed of our liberation. So if we can just back up a minute and not react, that will give us time to do what is important. If the person needs to hear something, like, "I need for you not to yell at me." Or if the person needs to hear something like, "You're being rude." If the person needs to hear something like, "I cannot stay here." Whatever you can, that way you are saying and speaking your truth from a place that is not angry. You're saying your truth from a place of clarity and strength, which clarity and strength is not the same as being angry. It's not. Because all of the great thinkers and all of the great activists of this world who really accomplished great things, they accomplished it through nonviolence. And so we have to find a way to be that way. And for many of us, it's disengaging from whatever negativity the other person is trying to throw at us. So that's a bit of a review of the setting our Buddhist motivation in the morning and taking refuge. The Buddha is our Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are our protectors during the day, in the middle of the day when it gets so hard. Sometimes we may have to say, "Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, be with me." Or even say a short prayer to our own Buddha nature saying, "Be strong, be with me." It's always there. We just have to remind ourselves. So that's a little bit about the midday. It's about holding that motivation and trying to embody that motivation even when things are difficult. And then when things are not difficult, extending ourselves in kindness to others and seeing how they suffer and how we can have an impact on that suffering just by being kind. I have to tell you, one story from New York City. I had a scary moment. It can be scary. There are a lot of people in New York City. And going up and down the stairs at the subway can be an athletic event. I actually saw someone attempt to jump the crowd. It was scary. They were going the wrong way down the subway stairs. And they were trying to, like, leap over me. And I'm elderly now, so it's a little dangerous to leap over me. And they ended up pushing me over, and I was scared I would fall. I was only 4 or 5 stairs up, and I would have fallen the entire rest of the way down the stairs. But New Yorkers, they held me up and pushed me up so I would stay upright on my feet. And it was really scary, but they were there. They knew what it was like to face that kind of problem. And they knew that they knew the they respected the gray hair. They saw it and they said, "I think she needs some help." And this is what we can do and be for each other in this kind of nutty, busy, sometimes painful world that we're in, is watch out for one another. Karmapa said this also in his teaching. He said, we sort of need to look out for each other. So in any case, that was a little bit about the midday. And now we come to the evening. Presumably we have survived from the morning, that great idealistic motivation that kind of got tossed and turned in the middle of the day. But we reminded ourselves frequently. There are lots of ways to remind yourself frequently. Even if all you do is walk through a crowd of people thinking, may everyone who sees me be benefited. May everyone who sees me be connected to Dharma. May everyone who sees me be connected to Buddha. May everyone who sees me and says anything to me, may they be comforted. May they see their Buddha nature someday. So we've tried to hold up our end of things during the day, and now we come to the evening. We've survived up until now, and our motivation is still somewhat intact. So now it is the time to wind down for the day, and there is a Buddhist practice for the evening. According to my teacher, Kenpo Karta Rinpoche, the evening practice consists of reflecting on your day, taking responsibility for any wrongs you may have done, and rejoicing in any good you may have done. This is very important, because if we only pay attention to the mistakes we make, and we only pay attention to the wrongs we have done, we are not being 100% accurate in recalling our day, and not being 100% encouraging of the Buddha to be that is within us. And so that is why in traditional Lojong or mind training tradition, they ask the person to sit in front of their Buddha image, and after having bowed to the Buddha, they bring to mind their activities of the day. And for every wrong they have done, they make a mark in one column or put a stone in one bowl. And for every good thing they have done, they make a mark in another column or put a stone in that bowl. And in such a way, they recall and are very clear about everything. They don't sweep something under the rug saying, well, it was actually all right for me to speak badly to that person. They deserved it. There's none of that. Part of being a Buddha is being omniscient. Therefore, we're not fooling anybody. We might try to fool ourselves, but our own Buddha nature, it knows. So by doing this, we may feel at first that it's a little harsh and a little bit too much. But what we do after we've made the marks is really important. The marks that are negative marks, like, I almost pushed that person in the subway, or I was very willful in that conversation. I put somebody down who didn't deserve to be put down. You know, I was harsh. I did this. I did that. And when you're done with that, you think of the Buddha as being like your friend, your witness, your buddy, and saying to the Buddha, well, I think I messed up. And you know what? I'm not going to do it again. Kenpo Karta Rinpoche has said that this is actually very important. Feeling regret for the things that we have done that aren't correct. It's not using an invisible stick and beating yourself over the head. That's excessive. But what is important is to take responsibility and not try to sweep it away. Because taking responsibility is hard, but it's also what we have to do, because how else will we improve? Karmapa said this during one of his talks. He said, if we don't acknowledge where we have been and what we have done and who we have been, then how will we ever make a change? How will we ever make a change? So he said, it's important to do it. But then we have to do the other half of the page of the things we did that were good, where we lifted someone up, where we helped to raise someone's spirits, where we helped listen to a person who was upset, and so forth and so on. Those things we actually also have to take responsibility for and rejoice in and say, may I do more of these tomorrow. Personally, I like looking at the negative first, because then I can clear it away. And then I look at the positive next so that I can feel encouraged by it for the next day. And then after having acknowledged these things, if we have the good fortune to have a copy of what's called the Seven Branch Prayer, which is a prayer of homage and praise to the Buddhas, that says, I confess all of my negativities and I rejoice in all the good that I have done. Wonderful. But even if we don't have that prayer, we can say, I regret my wrongs and I rejoice in the goodness I have done, and may I do less wrong tomorrow and may I do more good tomorrow. And then we can actually take refuge again. We can say, I take refuge in the Buddha as my teacher, the Dharma as my path, the Sangha as my community. Because they are meant to be our protectors in this world of suffering the Buddha called samsara. And some people may say, well, how can an idea, the Buddha, an idea, the Dharma, an idea, the Sangha, how can they protect you? Oh, ideas protect us in the very best way. Ideas protect us in our heart. Because this world may be a world of confusion, but who we are inside, our mind, is what we carry with us always. And so to be kind to that Buddha to be that we are, to reassure them when they do wrong and to praise them when they do right. It's almost as though we are raising ourselves as children of Buddha. The idea is that we're raising the child that is our Buddha nature to be better day by day. And so we need that sort of parenting and protection from within us. Of course, Kempo Karcha Rinpoche, being born in Tibet, having grown up there with the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas as his companions, he says, the Buddha is not an idea. The Buddha is real. The Buddha is not some sort of Jungian archetype. The Buddha is real, and he really cares. And because he is enlightened and can be everywhere and see everything, he can be there for you right now. So when you call on the Buddha, he is right there with you, present in front of you. He said, don't doubt this, because the Buddha himself said in the sutras, in the scriptures, in the Buddha scriptures, he said, whoever thinks of me, I am present in front of them. So this is why remembering the three jewels of refuge in the morning and during the day and in the evening is a way of embracing our entire day with the protection from the sufferings of samsara, a reminder of our Buddha nature, and an encouragement to hold that motivation of wanting to benefit beings. So I think that's all I want to say about the evening practice, because there may be time for us to converse about the whole thing. Morning practice, midday practice, evening practice. I think that's all a good thing. If you do an evening practice, I'm sorry, if you do a morning practice that involves a shrine, like if you have a shrine in your home and you interact with it and you fill the water bowls in the morning as an offering to the Buddha, symbolic of all the great things of this world, in the evening, after you've said your refuge prayers for that evening, you take down the water bowls And you can put the water on plants. You can feed it to the cat or the dog. Or you can put it down the drain where it will benefit all the beings downstream. Whatever you do, then you wipe the bowls out and place them upside down on your shrine for the next day. And in that way, you have completed the cycle of the day. And then when you go to sleep, you can go to sleep with the knowledge that you are under the watchful protection of the Buddha, who is really present with you and is really your own nature, your own mind's nature. The protection of the Buddha, his teachings, these teachings on love, compassion, and wisdom that have held you up through the whole day, and the Sangha, all of those who have accomplished awakening before you, and who are your silent witnesses and encouragement as you go through your day. The Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are there for you in the morning, midday, and evening. And reminding us of their continuous presence is something that we can do, and it's good for us to do. So anyway, I could go on and on and on, but that might not be interesting. But we might have a discussion. I can either we can either discuss the Buddhist practice of morning, midday, and evening, or we can discuss what the Karmapa had to say, or we can discuss anything. The microphone is available, so if you have a question or anything, you can go ask. We use the microphone so that people listening to the podcast can hear the question. Otherwise, I have to repeat it, and I might not get it right. Good morning.
Hey,
I'm
Kathy.
Hey, Nan. I love that t-shirt, by the way.
I think you can get them here.
You can get them here, yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's decent. You might tip it towards you.
Yeah. Also during the day, I remember a wonderful story you told about a librarian.
Oh, yeah.
Who had a very difficult phone call and then ended up being nice to the next person. And you peeked around and she had a sign that said, fresh start.
Fresh start.
Fresh start. And so I keep that in mind during my day, not just at midday and evening and morning, but after a phone call or after a particularly hard task, I will do some Tonglin around my whole area. So I try to keep it going throughout the entire day, not just three separate times.
I really appreciate you sharing that story because a lot of us work in sort of high energy workplaces where a lot's going on. And so when a lot is going on, people can be quite brusque, and they can be quite actually cutting and unkind to one another in the name of getting something done. This happens. We get sort of bamboozled by the image of, like, I need to get this done, and this person or situation is in my way. And, you know, and we may be the person who's in their way. Who knows? But I really appreciate you sort of resharing back the story about the librarian. This happened at the Livingston, the Barnett Library at Livingston and Barnett. And it happened exactly as you say. The woman was getting, the reference librarian was getting off a very difficult phone call. I could tell she was distressed by it. And then she just looked down at her desk for a moment and then looked up at me and with the kindest and freshest smile said, "How can I help you? How can I help you?" And I peeked over and I saw that she had the words fresh start written right by her telephone so that she would be reminded of, then that's what we have to do. We have to find a way to set reminders. I actually put a reminder in my phone that goes off at 4 o'clock every day. And it said, "How's your bodhisattva vow?" Meaning, what harm have you done in the last number of hours, you know? And it really does help because it kind of refreshes my motivation. So thanks for sharing that. And this fresh start can happen anytime. So thank you for practicing that. That's actually really good dharma to practice that. So thank you. Yeah. Hello.
Hello. I heard Kenpo Rinpoche once talk about going to sleep and doing the manis when you go to sleep.
Om Mani Padme Hum mantras, yeah.
And then maybe, if I remember correctly, maybe waking up with them on your breath. I'm not sure about that. I think I'd also read somewhere that Barlar Tokum Rinpoche was talking, or I read it. Maybe you could visualize a white disc in your forehead when you go to sleep. So my question is, does Bokar Rinpoche, in the daily practice of a bodhisattva,
yeah.
Does he talk about practices actually for falling asleep? And
right.
Do we have freedom to choose, or do you recommend one or another?
Right. I mean, sort of where I go with this, I'm looking to see what precisely he talked about. And near the end of the book, he's really talking mainly about the three poisons and how we counteract the three poisons. So it doesn't really cover all of that. So, oh well, what he says here is he says at the time of going to sleep, he recommends, and so does Kempo Rinpoche, that if possible, to go to sleep with your body in the same position that the Buddha assumed upon his death, which was lying on the right side with your face against your right hand, you know, with your cheek resting in your right hand. Now, a lot of people can't do this, but if they could lie on their right side, fantastic, wonderful. Part of the reason for this is that it calms the mind to do this. So that's recommended. Kempo Karge Rinpoche once said, sleep, the state of sleep, is karmically neutral. So that means that sleep is neutral, but he said what you do before you go to sleep will flavor it. So I make the joke, I say sleep is like tofu. Because tofu is kind of a bland flavor, but it will take on the flavor of whatever you cook with it, right? And so if we go to sleep, and Kempo Rinpoche said, if you go to sleep worrying about something, it will flavor your sleep with worry. If you're angry at somebody, it will flavor your sleep with anger and attachment and desire, the same thing. So he said it's probably really wise to do some kind of dharma practice as you are going to sleep. And what Bokar Rinpoche recommends is the same thing that Kempo Rinpoche recommends. And he said that we can think that the Buddha or our teacher or a bodhisattva or whatever is above our head. We can think tomorrow, at such and such a time, I will get up and do my dharma practice.
I need to reflect on that a lot.
Yeah, and then we can visualize a luminous image of one of the Buddhas or bodhisattvas in our heart. I remember Kempo Karge Rinpoche, when he talked about this, he said, don't make the light too bright. It might keep you awake. So he said, just have it be a very soft light, very small image of the Buddha or whatever, you know, in your heart. And somebody asked him, well, if you're lying down, what is the Buddha doing? Is the Buddha sitting up? And he said, no, he's lying down to sleep just like you are. And this was a really lovely and kind way of thinking about it. He said, if you place your mind on this small image of the Buddha and think that the Buddha or your teacher is with you as you fall asleep in your heart, he said, this will flavor your sleep with devotion and love. And so he said, that's a really good way to go to sleep. So since sleep is sort of neutral, we have to flavor it in a way that's positive. So, yeah, he didn't recommend anything, visualizing anything in the forehead, just the heart.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. There's time for one or two more questions, if there's one or two out there. Any topic?
Gail McCarthy.
Hello.
Hi. I know you recommend the seven branch prayer at the end of the practice in the evening, and we have it in English and in Tibetan.
Right.
And I'm sure this is something you've addressed before, but I could use a refresher. Do you recommend saying it in one or the other or both?
Right. I've talked to Kempo Carter Rinpoche about the use of English and Tibetan in prayers. And what he has said on other occasions, specifically about the Mahamudra preliminary practice or the Nundro, is he said you should really do it in English until you become super familiar with it. Somebody actually asked him for a number. So he just picked a big one. He said, 10,000. Just do your first 10,000. Not that we're going to keep track. I mean, come on, right? But because people pushed him for a number, he gave one. But I think that what he really means is that English is the language that we are used to and familiar with, and it will help us to gain insight into the meaning of the words. So we should emphasize English at first. And my personal feeling, now that's where his advice ends and mine begins. I sort of feel that if once we get really familiar with the meaning of the words, almost till we have it almost memorized, I think that that would be a good time to talk to one of the teachers here and to get a lesson in how to pronounce it in Tibetan, and then try to do it in both for a while, and see if that helps bring meaning to the Tibetan as well. Does that make sense?
Sure, yes. Would you apply that to the Tashi prayer as well?
Sorry?
Would you apply that to the Tashi
prayer? Yeah, I would apply that to the Tashi prayer also. Okay. What I have found, I've taught a number of people the Tashi prayer. There's who doesn't know the Tashi prayer? There's a few people who don't know it. Yeah, okay. Tashi prayer, okay. History of the Tashi prayer is that the Buddha was asked during one of his teachings, what is the best way to bring auspiciousness to any situation? How to make something good and bring goodness and auspiciousness to a situation? He said, oh, easy. Recite the names of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. And so then the sutra is huge and long and repetitive, and there's a lot of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that get named over and over and over again. So what happened was in the 19th century, a Tibetan teacher named Mipham Rinpoche extracted just the names and put them in a prayer so that it could be easily recited by anybody. But the names are in Sanskrit. So it's a little challenging to read the names of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in Sanskrit. But what I have found is that when you read the names of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in Tibetan, it's a little easier. So I have seen English translations of the Tashi prayer that name them in English, I mean not English, name them in Tibetan and others that name them in Sanskrit. Find the one that works the best for you. I do find the Tibetan pronunciations of the names are easier. However, they have English names that are kind of poetic but don't make sense. Like cool moonlight and, you know, so forth and so on. So yeah, the Tashi prayer. But once you know the Tashi prayer really well, it is said in the colophon, in the ending, end notes to it, it said if you say it in the morning, it says you will have the day's fulfillment. If you say it in the evening, it will help you have pleasant dreams. And so I took on the practice of saying it morning and evening, and now I have it mostly memorized, although I can get into a loop with it sometime, and then I can't get off the loop.
Well, that was part of the reason for the question. I have it memorized, but I don't have the meaning of it memorized, and so I was wondering if maybe
yeah, I think it's time to backfill. Okay. Since you don't have the whole meaning,
right.
And why not? Just do it in both for a while until you can pick that up. And then you can sit down, and I can probably in about 20 minutes, I can point out keywords in Tibetan that you can learn. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Time for one more. Is there one more out there? One more.
Sure.
One more. Okay, good. Thank you. I have an opinion about this, and that is that every time you ask a question, it's one of the seven branches. You're asking for the Buddha, the wheel of Dharma, to be turned. Not that I'm the Buddha, but that I memorized some stuff, and I can recite some of it. Yeah.
So this is a little bit less related to daily practice, but I've been meditating on emptiness and totality, you know, whatever you want to call it, a lot lately, and specifically Nagarjuna's view of all phenomena, even the mind itself, being empty of intrinsic existence. And with external phenomena and even thought forms, that makes a lot of sense to me, but I'm sort of coming up against a wall with the emptiness of the mind itself.
Right.
And
yeah.
I was wondering if you could help elucidate that.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. That's a little bit deep for this morning, but what I will do is I'll say a couple of things, and then I've got a book for you to read. The book, let me give you the book title first. It's called Meditation on the Progressive Stages of Emptiness. Did I get that right? Anybody else? Is it Meditation on the Progressive Stages of Emptiness? It is really good because it addresses exactly this question. Your question is most clearly answered by the explanations in this book, and they'll even tell you how to meditate on it.
Who is the author?
The author is this really brilliant scholar named Kempo Sultram Jamso, and I'll write it down for you if you stay after. G-Y-A-M-T-S-O, Sultram, T-S-U-L-T-R-I-M, Kempo Sultram Jamso. It's a brilliant scholar. And he teaches these views, and each section of the book talks about the progressive stages, meditation on the progressive stages of emptiness. And so what you have meditated upon up until now takes you to, like, I think you're three quarters through the exercises in the book. But that last exercise is a little bit difficult. And this is because there are several different views on the mind. And so one of the views is called the Rongtong, or a self-empty view, and the other is called the Shentong, or other empty view. Because I'm not much of a scholar, all I can do is name them and define them. But how to define the Shentong view is that emptiness is empty of everything except... That's the wall you're hitting. Emptiness is empty of everything except Buddha nature. That Buddha nature actually transcends this. It is neither existing nor non-existing. Okay. The idea is that it is, they call it the great permanence because you can't describe it. And you can't kill it. It doesn't have a beginning, so it doesn't have an end. And it is not a material thing. The mind is not a material thing, but it's not nothing because it knows and experiences. And so the Shentong view describes with words that which cannot really be described, which is that the mind is empty of limitation and empty of solidity, and yet, paradoxically, it knows, K-N-O-W-S, it knows and experiences and can actually experience itself. So that is, that knowing and experiential aspect of mind is called luminosity or clarity, and the non-establishedness, if that's a word, of the mind is called its emptiness. And this is explained more clearly than I will have done in this book, where he describes the Shentong view in detail. But the wall you're hitting, in my opinion, which is, you know, probably worth about 25 cents because I'm not a scholar, but to the best of my ability, the wall you're hitting is the wall that is the great permanence of Buddha nature. You know, the idea, I'll tell a joke. Buddhists have jokes. And Buddhist scholars have really interesting jokes. Okay? Really, really interesting jokes. A Rongtong view and a Shentong view practitioner were walking down a street one day. They don't go into bars in these jokes. They're walking down the street one day, and one of them is killed. Okay, it's the wrong tong view guy got killed. And so the Shentong view guy is like, he's so awakened, he's watching this guy go through rebirth. Okay. And the wrong tong guy is like, I think I could figure out emptiness if I just was able to meditate right now. But nothing, 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 nothing. And the guy's saying, no, 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 something, 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 something. And it did, anyway, so the moral of the story is you have to learn both views. You have to learn both views or you'll be defeated. So one view is the progressive stage of the next. And that's, they may appear to disagree. I don't think I told that joke very well. first of all, I have to tell you, I think I told the joke wrong. So, but I would have to go back and re-listen to a very old recording, and I won't know where to find it. So just skip the joke. Just pretend I didn't say it. Anyway, but they do. They talk about these things from that point of view. You know, nothing, nothing, nothing. You know, it can be reductive, and yet it can be pointless, because you won't see your mind's nature if you're saying nothing, nothing, nothing. So it's. I think I realized how I told the joke wrong now. Oh darn it! Okay, later we'll cover this later. So, but we'll talk about the book, and then we'll get that covered for you.
Thank you.
Okay. No, thank you. Yeah, I told that joke totally wrong. This is, okay, well, people listening to the podcast, I'm like super sorry. I told that joke super wrong. Yeah, it was a pointing out instruction. The wrong tongue guy was getting a pointing out instruction. It wasn't that he was being guided through the bardo. He was getting a pointing out instruction, but he couldn't hear it because it was always nothing, nothing, nothing. Sorry, I goofed that up. Totally goofed that up. Oh!
I just want to say this real quick.
Yeah.
There's a teaching that happened in 2006 at KTC, Jim Scott teaching on four schools of progressive stages of emptiness.
Yeah, so you can listen.
I have the MP3s. I'm going to try to revive that. I have CDs somewhere.
Okay,
that's
great.
10 hours
of teachings by Jim Scott, who was one of Kenpo Sotram Jamso's top students. Yeah. And he translated a lot of Milarepa's songs into English. Yeah, and he would be an expert on teaching the progressive stages of meditation on emptiness. So we'll get you connected. Yeah, before ending, I have one more practice note. If anyone is interested in chanting with us, we're going to chant Chenrezig next Saturday morning at the ComFest. At the Live Arts stage, show up at 10:30 at the Live Arts stage. We'll have a really quick rehearsal, and it's a one-page Chenrezig practice, very short. And then we'll do a lot. We'll do about 3 or 5 minutes of singing in the middle, and we'll bless the whole grounds from our stage with the Chenrezig mantra. We actually do need you because we don't have as many singers signed up this year as we've had in past years. So, and we always know that some folks have something happen the morning of the event and they cannot come. So I'm happy to stay afterwards to give directions and let people know where it is. And so Chantal and me, that we're going to be there. Is M here? M is here. Okay, M, I've just been looking at you. So anyhow, we're going to be there. So you can see us after and we'll connect you to what we're going to be doing. So let's dedicate the merit. We dedicate the merit of the goodness of our session today to all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be free from suffering, come to happiness, and then to Buddhahood. And coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. For more information about the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music on this podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.